At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Without putting too fine a point on it, politics this week? Oh, that's been a whole lot of talk. And the economy, though? Well, that's been a whole lot of results. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 5th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots to talk about today. What with the economy this week being all about results and all, as I was just saying. The most recent, of course, today's news, the economy added 531,000 jobs last month. So we are going to get right to it. Gina Smilex at the New York Times. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you. And I wonder if you'd agree that perhaps this morning after the jobs report came out, although, to be honest, they get the numbers a day in advance, one wonders whether there was a large sigh of relief coming from, number one, the White House, and number two, also the halls of the Federal Reserve Building.
You got to think there was,
Yeah. You
know, a 531,000 job gain after months of just kind of muddling along in the much lower 100,000 marks,
yeah.
I think had to be really good news for them. And, you know, I think that this was in many ways a good combo jobs report for them in the sense that wage growth looked strong, but not sort of bubbly. You know, it didn't accelerate far beyond what people were expecting, which is good. You know, sounds like maybe bad news to somebody who hasn't been paying attention to the inflation story. But given that inflation has been really high, I think they probably are relieved that wages didn't come in even stronger than they did. And at the same time, you're seeing workers coming back into the labor market, sort of filling some of these open positions that we've been hearing so much about lately. And so I think all around this had to just be a big relief for folks in policymaking positions.
Yeah, for sure. More coming up about wages from Mitchell Hartman in about six-ish or so minutes. Heather, let me point out something that you said on Twitter this morning, which I think really bears repeating here, that the speed of this jobs recovery, even though we're still down 4 million jobs, give or take, the speed at which the labor market has bounced back is kind of amazing.
It really is remarkable. I mean, frankly, I'm thinking there's cheering today in the White House seeing these numbers. You know, basically, the big picture is we've gained back 18 million jobs, and that's about 80% of what was lost. And, you know, it took years to do that after the Great Recession, and we've done it in a year and a half, basically. So overall, I think this is really good. I was particularly chuffed to see that not only was there a bounce back in restaurants, restaurant hiring, but also manufacturing was strong, and even dry cleaners. Talk about something that was so hard hit. You know, 28,000 jobs added, or for all these supply chain glitches we keep talking about, you know, auto manufacturing also had a really strong bounce back of 27,000 jobs. So I think when you look across this report, there's a lot to smile about. The only thing that still alarms me, we have to always put on our slightly journalist alarm hat. You know, obviously the labor force participation is still pretty weak, but I would say the big one that two that really scare me are the daycares and schools still really down, not enough people coming back to those jobs. And the other one is we can't point out enough that Black women were so hard hit during this pandemic and continue to really struggle to get back to where they were before.
Yeah, which goes to point out, actually, Gina, just real quickly, the unevenness of this labor market recovery, right?
Absolutely. You know, and I think the other thing that we're seeing, which is really interesting and is evolving, is that older workers are not coming back to the labor market, which we've talked quite a bit about, you know, it may be early retirements. But I think one thing that's worth watching is it's not always folks who are sort of at the traditional retirement years who seem to be lingering on the sidelines. It's basically the entire 55 plus cohort. And so I think that that's a real point of concern if those folks are left with fewer resources, you know, less ability to make it through retirement because they aren't working in these years. That's going to be an interesting story to watch in coming years. And so I think the underlying dynamics here are something to pay attention to as we, you know, celebrate what, as Heather said, is generally a pretty good news story.
Right. Okay. So from the White House, Heather, to the halls of the Marianne Echols building, the Federal Reserve building down on Constitution Avenue. Fed wrapped up a two-day meeting today. Chair Powell had a press conference, as he usually does. And in the course of that and in their statement before the press conference, the Fed announced that it's going to start tapering its bond buying program. That is to say, the treasuries and the mortgage-backed securities that it's been buying. Relatively slowly, right? It buys $120 billion a month. It's going to decrease that by $15 billion a month. Here's what I want to know, though, Heather. If I'm in Ottumwa, Iowa, making my car and my mortgage payments, or New York City for that matter, or Los Angeles, or anywhere, why does the taper matter to me? Why does this matter?
The easiest way that I explain it to my friends and relatives is it's kind of like taking the training wheels off of a child's bike. And on the one hand, it's encouraging. You think this kid, or in this case, this economy, can pedal on its own. You think it's strong enough to keep going. And that's really the big takeaway here, that the economy appears to be doing well enough that it doesn't need those training wheels anymore. But obviously, anytime you take away a support, like taking away those training wheels, there's always a little bit of nerves that that it's a little bit easier to wobble and me, you know, a little bit easier to topple over. And nobody thinks that's going to happen right away. But and the Fed is certainly going to be like that parent running with their hand behind the bike to try to, you know, keep it, ensure that, and that's why they're keeping those interest rates still at zero. But that's sort of how to think about what's really going on here and what was signaled this week.
Gina, let me ask you about what appears to be a mood shift at the Fed, right? For decades now, certainly since Paul Volcker and the late 70s, early 80s, the Fed has had inflation as its number one concern, rightly in the Volcker years when inflation was so high. But ever since, it's always been inflation, inflation, inflation. And now it seems to me that Powell and this Fed are saying, hold on a minute, we're not so worried about inflation. We're more worried about the labor market. And in fact, he's not in so many words, but he said that on Wednesday.
Yeah, I think it's a really remarkable change. And I think it's interesting at a time when inflation is very high to see them sort of being very cautious about how they approach their reaction to that. What the Fed is doing now is basically setting itself up to be nimble, you know, to have the option to react to this high inflation if it lasts. But they aren't doing that yet. And they're not signaling that they're going to act yet. And they're being very patient, you know, I think compared to what a lot of commentators would maybe even urge them to do. And they're doing that very much on the basis that the job market has not healed, that we are not back to full employment. We don't know what full employment is, but we know it's not this. They are really, really giving it some time and hoping to figure out what happens kind of by feeling around in the dark as we get into 2022. And so I think that is a pretty marked shift from what we had seen from the Fed previously.
Yeah, sure is. Gina Smilek at the New York Times and Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great weekend. On Wall Street today, so look, if you've been paying attention this week, you know what the music's going to be, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so picking up on something that Gina said, you had to read all the way down near the bottom of the jobs report this morning to find another nugget of good news, something called average hourly earnings for all employees on private non-farm payrolls. Wages rose again in October, up 4.9% year over year. But you got to listen all the way down to near the end of this next story to get the whole picture. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is our jobs guy.
When the pandemic hit, the economy shut down hard and fast, and millions of workers lost their jobs. But unlike after a typical recession, businesses started reopening and rehiring workers quickly. And now that the latest Delta wave is running out of steam, service industries are scrambling to hire, says Daniel Zhao at jobsite Glassdoor.
Wage growth over the last year has been strongest in leisure and hospitality and transportation and warehousing, sectors where we've heard the most acute reports of labor shortages, where employers need to raise wages most aggressively to actually attract workers.
Wages for non-supervisory and production workers are up 5.7% year over year. But there's something really important to keep in mind here. These wage increases are nominal, not real. And I don't mean imaginary. They're wage increases before accounting for inflation. And prices have increased, says University of Wisconsin economist Noah Williams.
Inflation is up somewhere between 4.5 to 5%, probably year over year. So, yeah, that 5.5% average wage gains is really only, you know, maybe a 0.5 to 1%.
In actual purchasing power. Now, lower-wage service workers are getting the biggest raises, more than 12% for bar and restaurant employees, around 8% for those in transportation and warehousing. But those workers are also the most vulnerable to increases in the cost of living, says Kate Bonn at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Wage increases that workers have seen recently are positive signs, but they have been balanced by inflation, particularly for workers who a larger part of their expenditures are things like used cars, fuel, utilities.
These big wage increases may not continue long term. Bond thinks workers will lose leverage as more people come off the sidelines to look for work and employers aren't so desperate to hire. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
While people are still talking in Glasgow at the big UN climate conference, there's a little bit of rubber meeting the road economic policy that's got to be talked about. It's relevant to getting us off fossils and onto renewables. The Biden administration says it wants solar to go from 4% of our electricity mix to 40% by 2035. That's a big jump in not a whole lot of time. And at a hearing this week, the solar industry told the International Trade Commission that it's not going to happen if the White House keeps a Trump-era tariff on solar panels on the books. Those tariffs, as tariffs theoretically are, were supposed to protect American solar manufacturers. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports today from the desk of Unintended Consequences.
When you're talking about tariffs on solar supplies, there are two different objectives.
Is the goal here to increase manufacturing jobs in the United States? Or is the goal here to deploy as much renewable energy as one can and therefore hopefully to mitigate climate change?
That's Jeffrey Ball. He teaches energy policy and finance at Stanford. So if the goal is to increase manufacturing jobs in the U.S., have the tariffs worked?
A bit, but not anywhere near as much as the proponents of tariffs long have argued they wanted them to.
Since the tariffs were imposed, solar panel production in the U.S. has tripled, but imports still make up 85% of sales. Some domestic manufacturers say they need more time and even stricter tariffs to compete. Mamoun Rashid is CEO of Oxen Solar, based in San Jose, California.
How do I possibly make a sale when my competition is offering a module that's been brought into this country and the price of that module is lower than my bill of materials?
Now, given that, there's the other question. How does the U.S. deploy as much solar as possible? Abigail Ross Hopper, president of the trade group Solar Energy Industries Association, says we need a different approach.
Like strong policies that support U.S. manufacturing, but those strong policies are not additional taxes that ultimately consumers pay.
Which is what these tariffs are. She says what's more, without imports, it's going to be impossible to meet the solar industry's obligation in Biden's energy transition goals. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Obviously, you can't just magically make more water appear.
Fact check. True. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 203 on this Friday, 0.5%, 36,327. The NASDAQ up 31 points, about 0.2%, finished at 15,971. The S&P 500 rose 17 points, about 0.3%, 46.97. For the week that was, the Dow added 1.4%, the NASDAQ up 3%, the S&P 500 up 2%. Been talking about those record highs all week. Also, you knew it was going to be the happy music, right? I'm just saying. Drug maker Pfizer shot up more than 10% today on news that its experimental COVID-19 pill is proving highly effective. The company said the drug cut hospitalizations by 89%. Rival Moderna dropped 16.5% today after the firm cut its forecast for vaccine deliveries for the rest of the year, blaming, Wait for it. Think supply chain. Wait for it. Shipping difficulties. Gas, by the way, $3.42 regular gas nationwide. That's from AAA, up from $2.11 a year ago. Bonds yield on the 10-year T-note. Go figure this one out. Down to 1.45%. We'll talk about more about that on Monday. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You have heard by now, I'm sure, about all the companies and all the countries promising they are going to be carbon neutral. 2050 is the most commonly offered date. But there is another environmental promise making its way through the corporate world with an even earlier date. Google and Facebook and Microsoft have all said they are going to be water positive by 2030. BP and Gap and a couple others say they are going to get there too. Might take them a little bit longer. Amanda Shupak wrote about all this for The Guardian, so we called her up to explain what is going on here. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I need a little vocabulary help here. Water positive. What does that mean?
Water positive. So being water positive means putting more water back into the environment where you operate than you take out.
Okay, how does that work? Because, I mean, yes, I know that, you know, all water on the planet today, you know, has been around for so long that it came through the dinosaurs or whatever, but it's not like we're making more water.
Right. So obviously you can't just magically make more water appear. That's not an option. So the actions that are needed to achieve these water positive goals that companies are setting, they typically involve a combination of first water saving strategies and then long-term projects that involve outside ecological or infrastructure experts to increase the health and resilience of the local watershed. And the part about the watershed is really important, and that's because water is a hyper-local issue.
Yeah, say more about that, because that was question number like three or four on my list, right? Carbon emissions are global by their nature, right? They get blown around and this and that. Mm-hmm. Water is water where you are.
Water is water where you are. That's exactly the point. Hyperlocal means that water issues someone faces in one place may be very, very different from their neighbor in another state or even their neighbor on the other side of that mountain ridge over there.
It's almost like that old bumper sticker, right? Think globally, act locally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As one of my sources said to me, using water is fine. The goal is to minimize the negative impact of the water that you use. And water means different things in different places.
Right. So in that spirit, tell me about the PepsiCo plant in Mexico that you talk about in this piece. Because this is, I mean, there's a little bit of greenwashing. There's a little bit of sort of engineering going on here. There's a lot going on.
There is. So the Mexico Valley watershed is in serious trouble. The water table levels are so low that the city is actually sinking. People do not have adequate access to clean water. The infrastructure is in serious disrepair. And then you have companies like PepsiCo and others who have major manufacturing facilities there. And so what Pepsi realized they have to do is, well, something, right? Like this just isn't sustainable.
Right.
They're trucking in water from far away in order to make sodas and snacks, and they can't keep doing that. It's really expensive. And it also is like not a great look, although that's not how they put it to me. What they are doing is first they're finding ways to use less water and then also to treat water on site so that they can reuse water. And then they're even taking some of that reused water and using it somewhere else. So the example I give in the story is they have to clean out the tanks and the pipes when they're switching from like Pepsi to Mountain Dew. And after they clean out those pipes, they can take that water, they can treat it, put it in a truck, go, I think it's 9 or 15 miles across town where they have a factory that makes chips, and they can use that water to clean the potatoes that they cook into the chips.
Which is, on the face of it, great. And if these companies live up to their water positive promises, that is a net positive for the environment and for humanity in a time when water is only going to get more scarce. But what's the risk, do you imagine, that these water positive promises and pledges become a little bit like, oh, we're going to be carbon neutral by 2050? And companies and countries are saying that. And there's a very large grain of salt that has to be had with that.
Oh, yeah. The risk is high. That grain of salt is indeed large. I mean, it is a problem that these are voluntary pledges.
Yeah.
And the experts I spoke to said it's very important that we see things like milestones in between now and 2050. I want to see all the numbers in your sustainability reports. All of these things will help keep companies accountable. But at the end of the day, if they miss those goals, all they have to do is shrug.
Right. Amanda Shupak, writing on climate and science and a bunch of stuff most recently in The Guardian about water positivity. Amanda, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. Nice piece.
Thank you so much.
All right, I'm just going to own this. Yesterday, well, it was a rough ride for Peloton. The at-home fitness company, it most notably of the internet-enabled bikes, hence rough ride, cut its sales forecast by about $1 billion thanks to subscriber growth that slowed way down last quarter. On the other side of the workout bench, though, the brick-and-mortar gym chain Planet Fitness says its membership levels are nearly back to pre-pandemic peaks. So you remember all those predictions the pandemic would make gyms extinct? How are they holding up now? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on that one.
There's plenty of people getting their pump in at Summit Strong, a boutique gym in downtown Denver, especially in the evenings when things get pretty social.
There's a handful of guys that'll work out at night that they start a volleyball league or they had like a kickball league that they all played on and they all met each other through the gym.
Bridget Schirmers is general manager. She says these days the squat racks function more like office water coolers.
Because they're working from home, they're not really interacting with a lot of people at work, not really making a lot of connections. So the gym is where they primarily meet people.
2020 was a rough year for gyms. Plenty went bankrupt. But Matt Powell, who analyzes the fitness industry for market research firm the MPD Group, says there's a recovering market for exercising with others.
Some people would really enjoy the community of being in the gym.
He says it's not just resurgent gyms hurting Peloton. There's also way more competition in the home workout space from brands like Mirror and Tonal.
I think everyone saw the early success the Peloton had and said, let me get a piece of that business.
Much like the workplace, exercising is becoming hybrid for many people, some days at home, some at the gym. Rich DeSilva still loves the Peloton he keeps in the basement in Mansfield, Massachusetts. But now that the Delta variant feels less threatening, he's back running and lifting at the gym. It's not really community he missed, it's competition.
I feel more motivated with other people around, knowing that they're kind of watching your performance and how you're doing.
DeSilva's not going to the gym to join a kickball team. But there's something about the gym that lets him be alone with others.
I enjoy being alone at the gym, having my headphones on, no one talking to me, but yet still having those people around.
I totally get that. Plus, it's weird to ask family members to spot you. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping once again with the policy of this program that if we stop talking about this stuff, we are going to stop talking about it. The overall unemployment rate in this economy, we learned this morning, ticked down to 4.6%. The unemployment rate for black Americans, steady, 7.9%. All right, we're going on a Friday. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. One more jobs thing, because as I believe I have said, a time war two, jobs are the whole smash in this economy right now. After millions of women left or were forced out of the workforce over the past 18, 19 months, 200,000 women came back into the American labor force in October. Thought that was worth pointing out. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassid is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.